Barn.
A scooter, there you go.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Monday, February 2nd, 2015. Thank you, everybody, for being here today. The first item, we're going to go to organizational meeting first, a little on off the agenda. And the first item will be the introduction of committee members. And we'll start with Representative Post. If you'd like to introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about you.
Representative Bill Post from House District 25, which is Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And my first rodeo, so good luck.
I'm Ann Leininger. I represent House District 38. That's Lake Oswego and Southwest Portland. I live in Lake Oswego, and this is the beginning of my second year as a rep, my first full session. Glad to be here.
Sherry Springer, State Representative, House District 17. I represent the eastern, some of the eastern portions of Linn and Marion counties. It's all a very rural district. Lebanon is my metropolis. I also represent Waterloo, Sweet Home, Scio, Staten, Sublimity, Gates, Mill City, Lyons, Detroit, and Idana. And I'm thrilled to be on this committee, frankly.
Thank you.
Andy Olson, State Representative from Albany.
Jeff Parker, State Representative from Beaverton and Alloa. Channel, please, go ahead.
Shannon Newell, I'm Committee Counsel.
Jennifer Williamson, House District 36. It's downtown, northwest, and southwest Portland.
I'm
next
Mitch,
to this guy.
I'm Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, northwest Portland, and way out into Washington County.
And Representative Krieger is from the southern coast. He couldn't be here today, and Representative Barton is from the Clackamas County, and he was not able to be here today. And go ahead, if you two would introduce yourselves as well, please.
I'm Committee Assistant for the House Judiciary Committee.
I'm Christy Arrington, Committee Assistant for House and Senate Judiciary.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Committee. The next item on the agenda is the adoption of the committee rules.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2015.
Representative Olson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd, 2015. Is there any discussion? Is there any? None at all. Okay. Seeing none, the motion passes and the rules are adopted. And just one thing that we didn't have in the rules that I would like to state early to, like, early in the session, like the first day, is we plan to try to be out of here at 5 o'clock throughout the rest of the session. You've got people that have important things to do that need to be going home. It's a late committee meeting, 3 to 5, but this will be a pretty standard get out of here at 5 o'clock. So if the day the big bill comes and we're going to go home at 5, I want people to know ahead of time that's what we're going to do. So it's not like we're going to be picking on anybody individual on their bill. So thank you. Okay. First, open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2339.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2339 is an Oregon Justice Department bill. Currently, Oregon courts have to appoint interpreters for non-English speaking parties or witnesses if it's necessary, and they also have an obligation to supply assistive hearing devices to persons with a disability. But they're not expressly authorized to provide interpreters to a victim who is in attendance at a hearing. Victims have a constitutional right to participate in proceedings. And House Bill 2339 extends the requirement that courts appoint an interpreter to include those victims who are exercising their rights.
Okay. Call up three people at a time. Joshua Nasby, Brad Berry, and Joanna Costa, please.
He looks a little different, Mr. Chair. Nasby.
And you start in New York. Just identify yourself for the record.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Josh Nasby, and I'm with the Office of the State Court Administrator. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. House Bill 2339 is a straightforward bill, but it addresses somewhat of a more complicated legal issue. The bill requires a court to appoint an interpreter for a victim of crime who seeks to exercise in open court a right granted by the state constitution, Article 1, Sections 42 or 43. And I think for present purposes, the most important right granted in the constitution is the right to be present at a critical stage of a criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding. And by way of comparison, victims of crime are also granted a right to be heard in court proceedings. So they have an opportunity to communicate directly with the court in a number of different circumstances. And under the law as it exists today, the scope of the right to be heard is clear, and the interpreter statutes are structured in such a way that there's little doubt that the court's required to appoint an interpreter in that situation. The more challenging issues are whether the victims have a right to an interpreter when exercising the constitutional right to be present, and whether the court has the authority to appoint one. And so what the bill does is it provides clear answers to those questions as a matter of statutory law. The bill clearly grants crime victims the right to an interpreter, and it provides the court with the clear authority to appoint the interpreter. And so that's the focus of the bill. There's one other thing in the bill that I just want to bring to your attention. House Bill 2339 eliminates the suggestion that the court has the authority to charge a non-English-speaking party for the costs associated with appointing an interpreter. That's consistent with what we do now. We do not charge folks for an interpreter. And I think more importantly, it's consistent with federal civil rights law. So for the main purpose of the bill is to clearly provide victims of crime with the right to an interpreter. And that
thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I'm here for myself as well as the Oregon District Attorneys Association. A couple of comments about this bill. Start first with the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 42, is the provision in the Constitution which guarantees victim rights. And in part, it ensures the victims a meaningful role in the criminal and juvenile justice systems. I point out that it requires a fair balance to be struck between the rights of crime victims and the rights of defendants. And as Mr. Nasby said, one of those rights enumerated is the right to be present at trial and at other critical proceedings. Some time ago in my office, we had a case which was scheduled to go to trial. It was a domestic violence case where the Spanish-speaking wife had been significantly injured. The case was set for trial, and as the various proceedings went on, she attended every proceeding that we had, each release hearing that we had, each motion hearing that we had. And as the case approached trial, my staff came to me and pointed out that she would not have the ability to sit through trial, listen to the testimony of witnesses, and have any idea what those individuals would say, what they would present that they said she said in the past, what the defendant said, facts that had been relayed to officers or others, and that she'd have no right to, she wouldn't have the ability to understand. I filed a motion with the court on her behalf asking that an interpreter be appointed for her, and ultimately the presiding judge in my county agreed that not only was it the right and fair thing to do, but it was required by the Constitution for her to have a meaningful role in the proceedings. And the court appointed an interpreter for her. In that particular case, at the last minute, the defendant opted to change his plea, and the court continued that order not just for trial, but for the purposes of the sentencing proceeding, such that she would be able to understand statements of defense counsel, statements of the defendant, statements of the prosecution, queries and statements of the court, as well as to have her statement interpreted for the court. Ultimately, my presiding judge informed me that all was well and good there until matter went up to the judicial department, wherein the judge was apprised that there was no mechanism for funding an interpreter for victims, and it wasn't specifically dealt with in the statute. And thus we find ourselves today with a bill coming from OJD recommending, asking you to look at this as an important piece of the criminal justice system. I've said many times in dealing with victims' issues that everybody in the criminal justice system is there because they choose to be. Defense counsel, by their choice in jobs, prosecutors, law enforcement, even the defendant by their conduct, is there of their own doing. Everyone except the victim is in the criminal justice system because they choose to be. Victims come into court, they're drug in, they come in under subpoena, and I think the least that we can do for victims in particular is to provide them with an opportunity to have an understanding of what goes on in court in a case that is most important to them. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Thanks.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Johanna Costa. I'm the Director of Victim Services in the Washington County District Attorney's Office. I've been doing advocacy work for over a decade, specifically at the District Attorney's Office for the last 7 years. I've been the director of the program for the past 4 years, and I've worked with all types of crime victims. I started my career working with domestic and sexual violence survivors in a community-based environment, and again, for the past 7 years, have been working with all types of crime victims in Washington County at the DA's office. As Brad was saying, crime victims are the only folks who are engaged in the criminal justice process, not of their own choice. And it is important for crime victims to participate in the criminal justice process. We know that based upon fairness. We know that based upon what is right. We also know that from a trauma-informed perspective. Being trauma-informed requires that we look at the impact of proceedings on crime victims. And what we know with regard to the criminal justice process and victims who are engaged in the process is that the folks who get to play an active role and participate in the criminal justice process are the folks that we are setting up best for healing and for taking steps forward in their recovery from a criminal act. What I tell crime victims is that it's my role as a crime victim advocate to make sure that they are experts in criminal justice 101 by the conclusion of their case. It's my job to make sure that they understand the process, that they understand what their rights are under Oregon Constitution and statutes, and that they understand how they can participate in the process. Our Oregon Constitution gives victims a constitutional right to play a meaningful role in the process and to have a fair balance struck between the defendant's rights and crime victim rights. It is the just and right thing to provide victims in word in the statute a right to an interpreter. We in Washington County are one of the few counties who have had a judge grant a crime victim's family an interpreter for a 4-week homicide trial. This is a family who was engaged in the process and in the system for a decade after the murder of their son. They were not primary English speakers, and so we provided them an advocate in Spanish. We know that folks receive best services when they are informed in their primary language, but when it became time for trial, we petitioned the court, and after a very long ordeal, were approved for an interpreter, found out from OJD that that would not be paid for. And so we were lucky in that Washington County Circuit Court stepped forward and paid the cost of that interpreter. But that is not common practice throughout the rest of the state. This House bill would move forward victim rights to make sure that they are able to participate in a meaningful way in the process. One thing that I do want to point out is the language, and I know it's historic language, but non-English speaking victim. I want to be clear that what we're saying is that folks who may not have full command of the English language are afforded this right as well. There are some crime victims that we work with who can eke out a few sentences in English, but that does not mean that they should not be afforded the right to an interpreter. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this might be for you, Josh. In the definition of non-English speaking, does that include deaf and hard of hearing, the deaf and hard of hearing community, and is ALS, American Sign Language, considered an interpretive service that the state must provide?
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson. So there's actually two different sections of the law that deal with these, mm-hmm. with what the law refers to as non-English speaking persons, and then there's another section, which is Section 3 of the bill that deals with persons who have a physical hearing or speaking impairment. So that answers your first question. I think the answer to your second question is yes.
Are the requirements the same depending on where you fit the deaf and hard of hearing community as far as either being a non-English language speaker or someone who has a disability? Does that make sense?
I believe so. Chair Barker, Representative Williamson. Statute talks about the court shall appoint whenever necessary.
Okay.
And so both statutes are consistent.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Shannon White and Aaron Knott, please.
Good Chair Barker's members of the committee. My name is Shannon White. I'm the Deputy Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. We are, for those of you who don't know, we are a statewide advocacy organization. We've been in Oregon for 15 years, and we believe in advocating for a smarter and more effective public safety system and criminal justice system. We know that that means that accountability comes first. We need to provide services to victims and invest in prevention services that reduce future crime. Those are the values that drive our work, and that's why we're here today in support of House Bill 2339, which you have already heard would provide interpretive services to victims. Clearly, everyone needs to have the right to participate in their own trial or hearing at every level. And we know that often if interpreter is not provided, family members often end up providing that service on kind of an ad hoc basis, and that is both unfair to the family member and to the victim. So we are thankful that the Judicial Department identified this problem. It's clearly been overlooked in other victims' rights legislation and brought it to your attention. So we support this bill and hope that you will as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the Legislative Director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice, which includes our Crime Victim Services Division, here in support of House Bill 2339. As all of you know, the state of Oregon was groundbreaking in moving forward with victims' rights, but like any truly complex piece of legislation, it needs revisiting from time to time to make sure all the pieces are working correctly. And we're in agreement with others that you've heard from that this represents a fairly significant pothole. You can imagine going to something like a release hearing, you know, a person that has victimized you. As a matter of legal status, you have been victimized, and you're sitting at a release hearing where this person may or may not be released, forced to rely on translation that may or may not be there, family members who may or may not be available, or your own ability to just sort of figure it out. If that sounds traumatizing, it's because there's all the evidence we have is that it is, as you've heard from others. So the Department of Justice joins in our partner with our partners in law enforcement and the victims community in support of 2339.
Thank you. And I just would say I recall a case where a young son was asked to interpret for the family, and he wasn't talking. He said, "Why are you telling your mother what's going on?" He said, "Well, I can't tell her about this violent crime. I can't. I'm, a, you know." So, it was he wasn't a true interpreter. So this would handle situations like that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to go into work session.
Yeah. This is a public hearing. Open work session on House Bill 2339.
Mr. Chair, I move that. Actually, we move House Bill 2339 as proposed to the House floor.
Due pass.
With due pass, yes.
Representative Olson moves House Bill 2339 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Yes, I should have discussed.
Who would like to be? Who's the?
It's an OJD bill.
I can carry it.
Okay. Representative Williamson will be the carrier. Thank you. We're going to step out of the bills for just a second, and we're going to open a work session on House Judiciary bills for introduction. Qualifying statement: a vote in favor of introducing the legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself. It is not indicative of a member's opinion or position on the concept, contents of the concept.
Chair Barker, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 1353, dated 12-1-2014, LC 1926, dated 1-9-2015, LC 2396, dated 11-10-2014, LC 2848, dated 1-14-2015, LC 2849, dated 1-14-2015, LC 2850, dated 1-14-2015, LC 2851, dated 1-14-2015, LC 2984, dated 1-20-2015.
Representative Williamson moves to introduce the LCs as committee measures. Is there any discussion? And just for information for new members, this is just introducing bills as a committee measure. Voting for it doesn't mean that you're supported at all. We're just getting it into the pipeline.
Thank you.
Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Next bill will open is House Bill, open a public hearing on House Bill 2700.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2700 comes to you from Representative Williamson and Representative Reed. It establishes a sea prey rule within ORCP 32 and directs 50% of unclaimed funds or unclaimed money left over after a class action lawsuit to the Oregon State Bar for the sole purposes of funding the legal services program. The remaining 50% is to be distributed to any entity that the court determines is directly related to the class action or directly beneficial to the class.
Thank you. Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I represent downtown Portland, Northwest, Southwest Portland, and House District 36. Thank you for hearing this bill today on the first day of our Judiciary Committee. If you don't know, it's Groundhog's Day, and it may feel like it in this hearing. Since last session, 2014, House Bill 4143 was introduced. This bill is functionally the same bill. Since February, Representative Reed and I have been working with folks, both the courts, judges, lawyers, and parties who are interested in this bill on making this a better bill than 4143. The most important change, I think, is allowing judicial discretion in the remaining funds in a CyPRAE award, that 50% would go automatically to legal aid, but 50% could be directed by the judge to a next best purpose for that money. In a case where there may be a nonprofit that serves the group of folks who were impacted in the class, the judge has the discretion to direct those funds to someplace in addition to legal aid. But as we all know, legal aid in Oregon is in desperate need of financial support, with only one lawyer for every 9,400 low-income Oregonians. We are currently able to meet only 15% of the civil representation needs in the state. That's 15. As you all know, and we've talked about in the past around legal aid issues, one of the things that I find most striking about legal aid is if you want to reduce domestic violence in a community, you open a legal aid clinic, that there is a direct correlation between access to legal aid and the health and safety of our community, as well as the access to our civil court system. So the bottom line, colleagues, is that this bill is about doing the right thing for Oregonians, for Oregon consumers, the people who are our constituents. It's about making sure that the justice system actually works the way it's supposed to, so that Oregonians from every corner of the state have equal protection under the law and access to our court system. And when the system finds that someone ripped off, injured, or endangered Oregonians, that they are held accountable. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Williamson?
Yeah, sure I do. Representative Williamson.
Yes, Representative Olson.
I appreciate your concern with wanting to get dollars to legal aid. I mean, I signed on to this bill last year and the year before when then Representative Chris Garrett was pushing it. I'm curious, how much time generally does it, because I have no idea, how much time generally does a class action lawsuit take to come to conclusion? Because I'm thinking, gosh, I mean, what is it, the Pearson case right now is going on and on and on, and if I'm going to be dependent on thinking I'm going to get some dollars from that, you know, I might as well just go home and milk the cows and not ever come back. I mean, I don't know.
Having had cows on the dairy farm, I don't think you want to do that, Representative Olson. I can tell you all about it. That it's a very good comment. This bill is not intended to be the silver bullet to fund legal aid. Legal aid will come every budget cycle for an statutory allocation. I think it's incredibly important that we do not lose sight of that in this conversation. Supporting this bill or not, we need to allocate more funds to legal aid, and we need to do it on a regular budgetary cycle. So this is not the solution to that. What this is Oregon joining 48 other states saying if there is an award that a judge and jury have found that a party is at fault in a class action, that they're going to pay 100% of whatever that award is, and that they don't get to keep part of it because they can't find the plaintiffs in the class.
Okay, and I just have a follow-up
then. Sure, please.
Of the other states that you're referring to, how many of their laws have a retroactivity piece to that?
Well, Representative Olson, all due respect, I would not use the language retroactivity. What we've done in this bill is we picked a point in time in a litigation that would trigger this bill. We could have picked the time it was filed. We could have picked the time, as we did in this bill, when judgment is entered. But we picked a point in time in a legal proceeding that will trigger the application of this bill. So I would argue it is not retroactive, because entering judgment for all those judgments that have yet to be entered, it is prospective.
Just for my clarity, so what is the point in time? I mean, how does that, who determines that?
Well, as the drafters of the bill, we determine that point in time. We picked that point as the triggering point for this language in this statute, okay, or in this bill.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair? Yes, I'm sorry. Representative Greenlight.
Thank you, Representative. Could you give me a couple examples of the other 50% that a judge could award under at least one of these amendments or another? What sort of thing might that include?
Sure. Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, if you had a class action around, say, a cell phone, a cell phone carrier or something, I don't know. If say, they were overcharging low-income users of cell phones, then you could find a nonprofit that provided cell phones to low-income folks, or something that is much more targeted to whatever the injury is. And so that, what we built in here was some judicial discretion, so that if a judge says, no, that nonprofit directly impacts the folks who were damaged in this case, then those dollars would mean more if it went there. So they could have discretion up to 50%.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Let's call Travis Preswich, Lane Shetterly, and Megan Kovacs.
Thank you. Went first last time? Didn't you go first last time?
Thank you. Just remember to identify yourself for the record.
Please. Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lane Shetterly. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here on opening day. I think the last time I was here on opening day was probably to sit up on one of those desks. I usually kind of wander in around the second month or so when things are getting interesting. But we're starting off. And so thank you for your consideration today of House Bill 2700. I would just want you to know that I'm here as an attorney in private practice. I have a practice over in Dallas. I'm also a member of the board of directors of the Legal Aid Services of Oregon and the Oregon Law Center. I'm a member of the advisory committee to the Campaign for Equal Justice that supports legal aid. And I was also a member of the 2014 Task Force on Legal Aid Funding. So this is a subject that is near and dear to my heart. And I want to just start off by acknowledging that legal aid has been the beneficiary of strong bipartisan support from the Oregon legislature for many, many years, going back to and before my time in this body, both here in the Oregon legislature and also with our delegation in Washington, D.C. Legal aid is very grateful for that support. However, as you heard from Representative Williamson in her opening testimony, in spite of the strong support that we have had, we are falling behind in our need to provide legal services to low-income Oregonians. Representative Williamson gave you the 15%. That's the percentage of low-income Oregonians that we are presently able to serve. I want you to know that is down from 20%, which had been the point at which we were being able to provide service. National standards say that we should have 2 legal aid lawyers for every 10,000 low-income people. That doesn't sound like a lot. We're currently providing legal aid services at the ratio of 1 legal aid attorney for every 9,400 people, so basically half of what we should be able to provide. I want you to know also that we're not just sitting here with a cup in hand asking for pennies to be or millions of dollars to be dropped in our cup. I want you to know, too, that Oregon lawyers support legal aid through the Campaign for Equal Justice. Last year, I think about 3,000 lawyers contributed about $1.2 million to the Campaign for Legal Campaign for Equal Justice to support legal aid. But the need is great, and so the resources must be sufficient to match that need. Clearly, we're not going to match that in this session. This bill, as Representative Olson mentioned, is not going to be that silver bullet, but we are in a situation where there's an opportunity here. It is an opportunity that, as Representative Williamson mentioned, is available in the great majority of states to provide funding for legal aid services. We appreciate your consideration. We do understand that the 50-50 split has been included in this bill. We think it's entirely appropriate that other providers of services to our clientele may be entirely appropriate for distribution of these CPRA dollars as well. And so we are supportive of that. So thank you for your consideration of House Bill 2700.
Thank you.
Representative Barker, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Travis Prestwich. I'm a lawyer here in Salem. I have a small practice. About five lawyers on our law firm, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar's Board of Governors. I was here last session. I'm also here as a lawyer concerned about providing adequate funding for legal aid here in Oregon. The Oregon State Bar's highest priority is access to justice. That is one of our primary missions, and this includes not only ensuring adequate funding for the court system, judicial system, but also ensuring adequate funding for low-income legal services, both on the criminal side of cases as well as the civil side of cases. Legal aid plays an essential role in providing access to justice for thousands of low-income Oregonians. For example, a legal aid attorney's advocacy can help a family stay in their home. It can help a domestic violence victim obtain a restraining order when necessary. And also do things like helping a taxpayer negotiate a settlement agreement that would be faster and with fewer missteps. In essence, legal aid lawyers and those that take on legal aid type of cases pro bono assist people through the process and provide for a more streamlined and efficient judicial system. It's estimated, as was stated earlier, that currently we're only meeting 15% of the need here in Oregon. In part, that's due to decrease in funding over the last several years with the Great Recession, but it's also due to a traumatic and substantial increase in Oregon's poverty population since the year 2000. Traditionally, legal aid funding in large part has come from the federal government through the Legal Services Corporation, but today those dollars only account for about 25% of legal aid funding resources. There are approximately 80 different resources that contribute to legal aid funding, as was mentioned by the former Representative Shetterly here to my left. Lawyers, we try to do our part as well by the Campaign for Equal Justice in raising those funds each and every year. Now, with respect to this particular legislation, the Oregon State Bar has historically supported CyPRA. And has spoken in favor of this particular doctrine. And Representative Williamson alluded to this in her testimony, but CyPRA essentially says that when a defendant has been adjudicated either through settlement or through a trial to pay a certain portion to victims, that if there are excess funds, those funds should go to the next best source. Currently in Oregon, any funds that don't go to a specific victim or where the victim can't be identified in Oregon's system are refunded to the defendant. Oregon is one of a couple of states at most that has that type of system. The large majority of states in our country, if not nearly all of them, including the federal judicial system, use CyPRA as a doctrine within the legal system. I will lastly say that the bar is committed to working with all of the branches of government, with the Campaign for Equal Justice, with the Oregon Law Foundation, and all other participants to ensure adequate funding. Again, this is not a silver bullet, as Representative Williamson said, but it could go a long way with the other multiple sources of funding to ensure that legal aid can get back to where it needs to be. Thank you.
Hi, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Megan Kovacs. I'm the education coordinator at Raphael House of Portland. And as Representative Williamson said, and other speakers here, legal aid is incredibly critical for survivors of domestic violence. Raphael House is a domestic violence shelter, and we work with a number of folks who have had their voices taken away from them. Legal aid is one way that we give people their voice back when they've experienced domestic and sexual violence. It's one way that people have access to justice. We worked with a survivor a few years ago who didn't speak English and had some difficulty and didn't feel safe pressing criminal charges against her partner for fear of retaliation. There wasn't an opportunity to call the police. She had never worked a job. She had very few financial resources. There was no legal documentation of the abuse she experienced, only the ways the trauma had impacted her and her children's lives. She really wanted a clean break and to start over, but she didn't think she would be taken seriously because of a lot of additional barriers that she felt she had, and because her husband had convinced her that she didn't deserve to feel credible and she didn't deserve to have a voice within the system. Legal aid helped her get that voice back. She was able to gain access to legal representation through legal aid, and coupled with the help of advocates, she obtained a protection order. She was granted a divorce. She fought for legal custody of her children. She had access to justice and understood that she deserved to have her rights respected and honored, thanks to being given a voice within the criminal justice system and the civil justice system. Sylvia's story highlights just how critical Oregon's legal aid services are to providing necessary support and advocacy services for survivors of domestic and sexual violence to get their voice back. Without legal representation, Sylvia would most likely have been forced to stay legally married to her abusive partner and place her children in harm's way every time she was forced to relinquish custody to her abusive husband if she was even able to make the choice to permanently leave the relationship herself. Legal aid really helps survivors of domestic and sexual violence find safety and find justice. So I am testifying strongly in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions from anybody on the committee? Representative Olson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess Travis or Lane, either one of you can answer this question, but I'm curious on page 2 of the bill, section 2, there's a portion in here that's been deleted, and it starts out, shall specify, are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's on line 38. It says, shall specify or describe those found to be members of the class or who. But it's been replaced with, starting on line 36, must generally describe the members of the class and must specifically identify any persons who requested exclusion from the class and are not bound by the judgment. So my question to you is, can you explain to me how this will impact the class action system here in Oregon?
Chair Barker, just Representative Olson, I'll do my best to answer unless she wants.
No.
No, that's not legal aid. I know.
I'll do my best to answer that question. I don't think, from what I've heard or from what I know from the last version of this bill, last session, I don't think it substantially changes the class, if it changes the class at all. Even though the description is different, it's my understanding that that language is necessary to enable the residual funds that aren't claimed by a particular victim to then be used for a purpose like legal aid or whatever the judge allows for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I think I would, and members of the committee, I think I would endorse Mr. Prestwich's answer. Obviously, my interest is primarily in sections 3 and 4 of the bill, dealing with the CyPRE, the CPRE aspect. I'm not an expert in class action. My understanding from last time was that this was a mechanical piece that helped make section 3 and 4 easier to implement and to identify that class. But apart from that, That's my information. It's only from what I heard when this bill was heard last time around. I don't have any personal experience with it.
Go ahead. I'll let you proceed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, that's right. It's a technical fix in order to define the class that includes those folks who are not identified, could not be found And so that the award portion that's left over, this is the operative language to allow that to be captured.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, go ahead. Yeah, just a few more. I mean,
sure.
You know. So, Lane, is there a preferred method of funding legal aid more than just this path? I mean, you've been here before.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Olson. I think as Travis said, we have many sources of funding, the largest being, I think, we have fee and general fund support from the legislature. I remember when I was in the legislature, we passed a fee bill that required out-of-state attorneys, when they appear in an Oregon court, they have to file a filing fee. We appropriated funding from that. That really was the best one. There were taxing people who don't live in Oregon to support our services. It's a great kind of tax to enact. And of course there is the federal funding. So the sources of funding for legal aid are many. Added together, they're still not enough. So that's what it boils down to. And the addition of one more source of funding can only help alleviate the shortfall. It will not fill that gap, but it will help alleviate it. We do understand that this is not ongoing, regular, recurring funding. That means that the bar and legal aid will have to be wise in how this money is spent when it is made available, so that it doesn't trigger expenditures that are just going to have to be eliminated, or positions or services cut when that funding has been spent. But you have a well-run legal aid system here in Oregon, shepherded by the bar, and I think the system is up to managing that.
So I just have a follow-up.
Please.
Just a little bit more. Okay, so Travis, I guess since this isn't my strength, I mean, I do have some questions more so along the line of where the federal class action law is. Are you familiar with that?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I can't say that I'm a specialist in either federal class action cases or in state. It's out of my typical practice area, so. I can only comment as to what.
There's supposed to be like about 27 other states that have mirrored that right now, and I'm just trying to get a handle on how close we are to that here, or you know what. So,
we have the Attorney General's office may have that answer when they get up.
Okay. Then, so you've studied the bill,
Chair Barker, Representative. Representative Olson, I've read the bill. I've seen compared the bill to the changes or to last session's version, and I would agree and endorse what Representative Williams stated, that efforts were made to address the issues and fixes that needed to happen. So, yes, I've seen it in that
Do
sense.
Do you see this as a major rewrite then?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, I don't see it as a major change, but I do think that the from a personal standpoint, I do think that there were the changes that were made make the bill better and cleaner than it was last session.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so we're spending a lot of time talking about legal aid, so obviously that would tell me that a big motivation in this was that funding piece. And I guess, Lane, this question is probably directed at you because you started down this road just a couple questions ago. I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around how this will actually and practically work. Whether I agree or disagree that this area over here should fund this area over here, that's a separate question.
Sure.
And I certainly have some questions about that and some concerns. But so we hear about class action suits all the time. I'm assuming in federal government, these big corporations, and they get sued, and I've gotten my $12 check or something like that before for some of them. I don't even remember what. So how would that money translate to the day-to-day operation of legal aid, since we're spending a lot of time talking about legal aid? Because you can't grow your staff and then shrink your staff and then grow your staff. You have no predictability whatsoever, and we're talking about appeals that sometimes take a decade. How's that actually going to work?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Springer. Of course, it's hard to answer that in the hypothetical, not having, first of all, the experience with it, not having the dollars or a particular case in front of us. I would say this, that other sources of legal aid are uneven. They're up and down from time to time. Certainly, the ability to husband a fund available to fill gaps as gaps occur during downtimes in funding could be valuable to maintaining services that we otherwise cut. Shortly after I joined the Legal Aid Services Board, because of a reduction in federal funding, we made significant staff cuts, which exacerbated the shortage. The shortfall in services, a fund available to mitigate those downturns in other sources of funding would be invaluable to legal aid services. Also, I think just in terms of smart budgeting, and especially as we get a history of this and begin to see how this plays out over time, and also looking at the experience of other states, I think it gives smart budget people the opportunity to put this in places where it can meet needs without creating those ramp ups that do result in cuts in services and programs and people. Not a very specific answer, except I would just say that we do have this experience to look at in other states where they are managing this very same kind of funding. It is certainly proving satisfactory to our anecdotal experience in those other states, and I think we have the people here with the ability to budget and manage this kind of funding in such a way that it provides the longest term benefit for legal aid.
Post, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we're talking about legal aid, sorry, I lean into microphones for a living.
That's okay.
So I'll lean back. Sorry, it's old habit. We're talking about legal aid. If this were to pass tomorrow and everything went the way you're wanting with this, how soon would legal aid start getting this money? 2 years, 4 years, six, eight? What? Just curious about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Post, I'm not positive on that. I see that, first of all, we have certainly not until the bill becomes effective, but I will say that when I was in the legislature, I assiduously avoided Ways and Means, so I don't have particular expertise. I know you have a member of the committee who does. Funds are continuously appropriated. I think that means that funds are passed through to the state bar. Representative Williamson is going to correct my answer here, because, as I said, legal aid, Ways and Means is just not my forte.
Mr. Chair, thanks, Lane. That was a good try.
A good try. Thank you.
You got close. We don't know if funds will ever be used through this mechanism. So there's no time and date at which funds become available to legal aid. This is a function of if there is a class action and there is residual damages and they can't find the plaintiffs to pay them and there's leftover money, then the judge would order that private party to pay a judgment to the state bar to go to legal aid. So it wouldn't come through the state, actually.
Right.
It would be private dollars being directed by a judgment by the judge. And so there's no predictability. What we're trying to do is align our statute with the statutes of other states to allow for this to happen. So if there is money, and that is the case, and a defendant has a judgment against them and $100 and they can only find $50 worth of plaintiffs, that $50 left over doesn't remain in the pocket of the defendant. It's ordered by the judge to go to legal aid.
Mr. Chair, Representative Post, that was my answer.
Thank you, panel.
All right, thank you very much.
Next, we'll call up Attorney General Rosenblum, Tim Nord, and Jane Downing could come up as well. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Rosenblum. I'm the Attorney General for the State of Oregon, and I come before you in support of House Bill 2700. Tim Nord, to my left, is an Assistant Attorney General who is here to answer questions after my presentation. If you have some questions, which I think you do, and he might be in a position to assist you there. I'm glad to be back. I did note as well that it was Groundhog's Day as I was preparing my testimony. So it is not only somewhat repetitive, but I have just cut about half of it because so much of what I was going to say has been covered by the previous speakers. I was a strong supporter of the fair distribution to legal aid of residual funds in a class action lawsuit in 2014, just last year, when it came before you as House Bill 4143. I return today to reiterate that support and to urge you to, again, end the peculiar and unfair practice of returning unclaimed award monies in a class action lawsuit to the very company or individual who caused the harm. This is a practice not followed by the vast majority of states, and it needs to end here in Oregon as well, in my opinion. It would not be surprising if most of you have been involved in a class action lawsuit at some point in your lives. Most of us have. If you didn't know about it or you didn't pay attention to it, you're in the majority. Often more than half of the victims in a class action lawsuit either do not receive notice of the suit or do not respond. Most of us find out that we're the victims in a class action lawsuit when we receive that letter in the mail, letting us know that we may be entitled to compensation, usually a very small amount. Someone mentioned $12, not unusual. If we fill out the enclosed paperwork and return it. And much of the time, the amount can seem like it's too small to even justify taking that time to return it. And so nothing gets sent back. It's also business as usual for the notice to go to a bad address or for no address to be found in your name. And therefore, you don't even have the opportunity to send it back in many instances. These very small amounts of money may not be enough to motivate every eligible victim to send the paperwork in, but all of these very small amounts can add up to very large awards. And if victims are so hard to find, so much so that in a typical class action lawsuit, it is not unusual to see over half of the award go unclaimed, the amount left undistributed is very significant. This raises the question for which House Bill 2700 provides an answer, what to do with all of that unclaimed leftover money, and that's what we're talking about here today. Oregon's current practice is to give the money back to the company or to the person who caused the harm in the first place. This makes no sense. These awards do not simply represent dollars awarded, they represent the very real harm that's been caused by these defendants. They represent carcinogens seeping into groundwater, heart disease caused by pharmaceuticals, unfair fees imposed on consumers. The fact that a victim can't be found doesn't undo the harm caused, and so it strikes me as unfair that an award should simply be returned to the person or the company that caused it. House Bill 2700 corrects this inequity through a legal doctrine that's been discussed. I think the only question is how you pronounce it. Is it CIPRE or CIPRE? I'll say CIPRE because I took French. It's a French term meaning next best, which allows these uncollected funds to go to a charitable purpose in lieu of going back to the culpable defendant. In around a dozen states, including Washington, these funds are routed in whole or in part to legal services for the poor. And this practice has been in effect for many years and across many multiple substantial awards, and has thus far been found appropriate by courts and by legislatures. So House Bill 2700 follows the path established by these states in requiring 50% of any residual amount to be deposited in an account dedicated to the funding of legal aid, with up to 50% eligible to be awarded by the judge to any charitable purpose related, must be related to the underlying harm, as Representative Williamson noted. So if you can't find a person harmed by cigarettes, for example, the next best thing might be to fund tobacco cessation. If you can't find a person sickened by an industrial toxin, the next best thing might be to provide support for treatment. If a judge does not make such a designation, the proposal permits the entirety of the award to be provided to legal services for the poor at their discretion. Like House Bill 4134, attorneys at the Department of Justice, including Mr. Nord here, were asked at my request to perform an analysis of the legal fitness of House Bill 2700. And like 4134, House Bill 2700 is legally sound. It's firmly modeled after well-established provisions from other states. It's not a taking. It's not a violation of due process or any other legal provision of which we are aware. I understand that many of the people who spoke on this issue have discussed some of these legal matters, but I think this is the first Assistant Attorney General that you've had before you today. So I'm not going to try to address every argument myself, although I'm sure I could do so brilliantly. Rather, I'll let Mr. Nord, if you wish to ask. He's really on the hot seat here. Of course, this bill is not new. Indeed, a very similar bill, very similar to this one, was introduced some years ago by Attorney General Hardy Myers and has been reintroduced several times since then, including as recently, of course, as last year. I don't know that anyone here would question that there may be no more worthy cause than providing access to justice for those in need of legal services and who are simply too poor to afford them. You've already been given a sense of the extent of the need here in Oregon this afternoon and how this bill would benefit our citizens. The bottom line is that legal aid, of course, needs stability of funding. This is not a bill to provide that stability of funding. And so I appreciate your question, Representative Springer. However, I believe that Mr. Shetterly gave you the best answer, certainly a better one than I think I could have thought of on short notice, to explain how, certainly with the right people installed as managers of these funds, we could do an exceptional job of providing what's needed to really provide that safety net of funding for those who simply can't afford legal services in our state, that 85% that we're currently not serving. And I might also add that one of the unique features of Oregon's legal aid programs is that they closely collaborate on funding and service delivery, and they strive to provide relatively equal access to justice to all Oregonians, regardless of where they live in the state. But still, the sheer size of Oregon presents its challenges. So passage of this bill would go a long way to help filling the access to justice gap that tarnishes our state and hurts our citizens who have nowhere else to turn for legal help at critical junctures in their lives. But it's also important that Oregon finally step forward and join our neighbors in taking the equitable step of not returning residual damages to the very person or company that inflicted them. It's time for Oregon to join the larger community of our sister states and make the right decision. So I urge you to pass House Bill 2700. Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Jane Downing, and I'm the executive director of the Center for Hope and Safety, formerly Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, serving Marion County. I have been the executive director now for 24 years and have worked with tens of thousands of victims and survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and human trafficking. And I appreciate the opportunity to come and on this first day of the legislative session. I was there last year at the last day, and you made a huge difference for victims of domestic and sexual violence in our communities by giving some additional funding to our programs. And I want you to know that those funds have made a huge difference in what we're able to provide in our community. So thank you for that. And I want to come today, though, to talk about one of our community partners that makes a huge difference for victims. Any given day, we are making dozens of referrals to legal aid. Unfortunately, they can't take all of those referrals because they don't have the ability or the staff to be able to meet all those needs. But I want you to know it's one of the number one referrals that we make, because the folks we work with most often have no access to resources. They're not able to hire an attorney to be able to help them through their cases. And many of them are complicated. And even having something as simple as someone with them for a contestment of a protection order can mean all the world to them. And that's what we, even if that was all legal aid was able to do, maybe on a short-term basis, is to help people with protection orders, it could make a huge difference in our communities. And so I really encourage you to think of maybe in a little broader terms. We talk a lot about public safety, and police are so important to the work that we do. Our programs are important. But when you look at public safety, broadening it one step further to think about if someone has an attorney in a proceedings, maybe they won't go back to that person. Maybe we won't have additional violence that happens to them. And so sometimes we have to kind of think about what a difference this might make in the lives of your constituents in such a way that they would be able to rebuild their lives free of violence and be able to be those self-sustaining, self-productive citizens that we all want in our communities. So I really hope that you'll take a look at this, and I appreciate your willingness to look at a little outside of the box to say, how can we make a difference for all the individuals who need the services of legal aid? Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, panel. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you. Oh, I was just wondering, Chair Barker, whether you had any questions for Mr. Nord. If not, that's fine.
We do.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Thank you, members of the committee.
I call up Brad Daniels and Betsy Earls, and we're going.
Sorry. Actually, if I could ask him just a couple questions.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Sure. Chair Barker and Representative Olson, my name is Tim Nord, N-O-R-D. I am special counsel, but prior to that position, I primarily did antitrust work in the department and may be one of the few attorneys in the department that has actually been involved with class actions and so forth. So I'm available to talk to you about cases we've had and are currently pending, and with respect to the bill, any questions you have as well.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chair and Tim. I don't know if you caught, I was sharing on section 2, page 2, earlier and asked the question, but I guess I'll ask you the same question because it sounds like you're well-versed in this area. But the one part that's deleted under line 38, if you're staying with me there, mm-hmm. has been replaced with the bold print starting on line 36. So my question again is, can you explain to me what impact this class action system will have in Oregon?
Well, the impact, the changes made are very consistent with the federal rule, Rule 23. And the prior language that existed, or that does exist, regarding a specific entry of identifying the person is how the current rule is set up, that does not allow for residual refunds. And, I mean, residual funds, not refunds back. That's what we're trying to avoid. But so it was necessary to make those changes in order to permit a residual fund. And I can give you kind of an example of that. Currently, the state of Oregon, we're on the executive committee, and I'm one of the co-lead counsels in a case called DRAM, and that is involving price fixing of the random access memory in your computer and smartphones and so forth. Over 30-some states joined together, and there were also private classes involved, and that case has now been settled. Well, we settled on behalf of consumers and end purchasers, both government purchasers and consumers. We had experts. We had the defendant's sales records. But those records don't show who bought the actual item, who may have paid cash, where those records were. We went as far back as 1998 for a damages period. So there is a damage amount that was negotiated and approved by the court. And then there is a description of the class. So, for example, it would say everyone who purchased these types of items during this time period will be barred from bringing any suit later, and they are considered part of the judgment. In contrast, the prior language would have required identification of those individuals, which, frankly, would be impossible.
So let me get my hands wrapped. Is this then, I guess, kind of starting to closely align ourselves then to what federal class action law is?
Yes. These changes would make the Oregon rule much more consistent with the federal rule.
Okay. And just one more question. When I was talking to Representative Williamson earlier, she mentioned a point in time. Did you capture that conversation that we were having?
Correct.
Okay. Can you explain that to me, where you see that fitting in this?
Well, the point in time that was chosen would be what I would consider the final time. And normally when a judgment is entered, you have the right to appeal for a period of time. If that appeal is timely filed, then you go up through the appellate process, which can go on 4 years. And the way this is written is until that appellate court might affirm the judgment, or it may send it back down for further proceedings in the trial court level. And so as this is currently written, it would not be until all the appeal or review times have completed. So basically the action, there's no further procedural or other action to occur.
Okay. Just one more question.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
Okay.
Do we have some cases right now that would apply toward that?
When we say we or the state of Oregon, I assume I would not know. We could probably try to get that information. I'm not certain, or we have not surveyed how many could be pending right now. And those could be at various different levels. They could have been filed yesterday, or they could be with the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now Brad Daniels and Betsy Earls, and we'll try to get John Masoner on the phone. Yeah, why don't you go ahead and testify first?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Brad Daniels. I'm a partner at Stoll Reeves. My practice includes litigating and settling class actions. I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2700. I want to make 2 points at the outset. First, I am one of the trial attorneys who represents BP West Coast Products in a pending class action in Portland. It's no mystery that this case has been discussed in connection with House Bill 4143 and may be impacted by the pending legislation. Second point is I don't think anyone on either side of this debate questions the importance of legal aid in increasing access to justice in Oregon. And whatever your view on class action procedure, I think everyone can agree that a strong and reliable funding source for legal aid is important. The problem from our perspective is that House Bill 2700 is a fundamentally flawed way to address that issue. And I'd like to briefly summarize those flaws and then discuss an alternative. I agree with previous speaker's opinion that this bill is not a silver bullet. The proponents cannot predict how many cases this bill would affect, what the effect would be, or when, if ever, it would result in a tangible impact to legal aid. The Legislative Revenue Office in the last session reviewed nearly identical legislation and was unable to determine how much revenue would be generated. Even if this bill were to impact one or more pending cases, and that in and of itself is uncertain, in the best case scenario, it takes several years for a case to be fully and finally adjudicated through appeals. Legal aid would not be able to depend upon that revenue for 1, 2, maybe even 3 bienniums. That's what we don't know. But what we do know is that House Bill 2700 deletes procedural mechanisms that have governed class actions in Oregon for over 40 years, and it replaces it with a vague and, to my knowledge, unprecedented procedural concept. It would allow a class action to proceed to settlement and judgment when plaintiffs can only provide an estimate of class-wide damages and when they can't offer any method for adjudicating individual issues or distributing those damages to individual class members. Now, the proponents claim that Oregon's current procedure should be changed because it's not how other states do it. But House Bill 2700 does not solve that problem, nor does it bring Oregon in line with any other state. No other state takes this type of procedural approach. And we know that this procedural change risks significant violations of the rights to litigants on both sides of the table. Oregon's current law protects individual rights of absent class members to decide whether to file claims in a class action. A number of people wish to exercise that right, and some don't. They want to make their own individual claims, or they have legal or philosophical objections to class actions or lawsuits generally. What Oregon courts do through the claim process is no different than what courts do throughout the nation, which is give people every opportunity to participate in a class action if they wish to do so. By allowing a court to divert damages from those who are members of the class to non-parties solely on the basis that it would be impracticable to run a claims process, and then to preclude class members who have not been made whole from bringing their own individual action, this bill risks depriving those class members of a claim and a remedy for their harm. The current law also protects the rights of businesses or other defendants by ensuring that they only pay valid and proven claims to people who are class members. By deleting those procedural protections, House Bill 2700 allows a court to impose an aggregate award of damages that no class member has actually claimed or proved, and against which the defendant has had no opportunity to defend. Courts have expressed serious reservations about this approach. I submit that there is an alternative. If you want to eliminate Oregon's unique class claim form requirement, enact a Cypre provision and give courts clear guidance for the future, there is a compromise way to do this. In the Dash 1 amendments, you can amend Oregon's rule and bring it into line with every federal court and many state courts, in fact, 37 state courts. Amending the rule in that way would provide the clear guidance that Oregon courts deserve. It would permit legitimate class actions to be certified and proceed while also preserving the procedural safeguards that are essential and have been developed by courts over many decades. Someone mentioned Washington earlier. That's exactly what Washington has. Washington's Rule 23 closely tracks the federal rule with respect to the procedural aspects of a class action, but it also includes a Cypre provision that directs unclaimed funds to legal aid. Oregon can and should take the same approach, as well as examine other permanent funding alternatives that the Campaign for Equal Justice Task Force identified. I submit that this would be a much better alternative and would avoid the risks and uncertainty that are inherent in House Bill 2700's unprecedented changes. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions? I have one. Just so the testimony we've heard says that 40 other states captured it. So if there's a judgment of $100 million, that $100 million is actually taken and something's done with it. Is that not accurate?
Chair Barker, it's not accurate that 48 other states do something that Oregon does not do with respect to unclaimed funds. What those 48 other states, or in our research actually indicates 37 other states in the federal system does, is enact a procedural system that ensures that class actions are only certified if the court can resolve individual issues, and then permits the court, after those individual issues are adjudicated, to design a process to distribute those damages to class members who make claims.
Okay, so if a judgment, though, I'm not a lawyer. So a judgment is for $100 million, and they only find 80. They can only find people to give out $80 million. Does the company who did wrong has a judgment against them able to keep the other $20 million?
Chair Barker, there's a number of different ways that courts approach that issue. If the $20 million is actually people who have made claims and there are simply uncashed checks, then courts, in their discretion, have pursued a Cypre. Federal courts have done that in their discretion, but they've also reverted those damages to a defendant, or they've diverted it to a charity of the court's choice. So it depends how those $20 million of, quote, unclaimed funds are distributed.
And am I correct in from what I'm understanding from testimony that in Oregon that $20 million stays with the person who had the judgment against him or corporation or whatever it is?
Chair Barker, it's not correct because the Oregon system actually has a procedure in place that requires class members to and allows them to make the decision whether or not to make a claim or not make a claim. So that $20 million could represent people who have chosen not to participate in the lawsuit because they want to keep their individual claim. They don't want to make that claim. They want to sue the company individually. Or they make a decision not to participate because they object to the class action procedure in general. So that $20 million under Oregon procedure or other claims made procedures in other courts does not represent the unclaimed funds that you earlier referred to.
Mr. Chair, I would like to ask the Attorney General's office to respond to this because I'm hearing the exact opposite from you, Mr. Daniels, from what I think I heard earlier from the Attorney General's office. So you don't have to come up now, Mr. Nord, to respond, but if we could, you want.
Well, I'd love to.
Well, I know that the Attorney General has not seen any amendment, and none of us who have been working on this bill have seen any of these amendments. So I don't want to put them on the spot with an amendment that nobody has seen. And, Mr. Daniels, I'd invite you to come back to my committee and testify on behalf of funding for legal aid in the Ways and Means process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Williamson.
Any other questions? Yeah, Representative Greenlick, please.
I think I understood what you said. This is my first day on judiciary. So I may not have understood what you said. But it seems to me you were arguing that the total amount at risk in a class action ought to be the sum of individual claims that have actually been made. Did I hear you say that correctly?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, that's the way that Oregon procedure currently works, and it's the way the procedure works in many federal claims made, either settlements or adjudications.
And your argument was that people who haven't claimed, I'm sorry, may I follow?
Please go ahead.
People who haven't claimed didn't claim because they thought the $12 they could get $40 more by suing privately, or failing that they objected to class action suits, so therefore they weren't willing to claim their own. And it seemed to me that's what you gave as the examples of the people who might not fill out that claim, even though ARCO charged me 40 cents every time they shouldn't have charged me, and all I have to do is submit 500 bills to prove I have $30 coming or something like that.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick.
I think I confused that question by the end.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, what I was referring to is the fact that there are circumstances where there are true unclaimed funds, which is people have made claims. They've expressed a desire to receive the money from a class action, either settlement or adjudication, and then they can't be found and the checks go uncashed. But that's not what this bill changes in what current Oregon law is. What Oregon law is it allows people to make a choice after a full and fair notice process to decide, yes, I'm going to make that claim for that money, or no, I either want to preserve my individual claim and sue the company separately, or no, I want to forego that relief in general because I have some objection to it.
May I just ask one more?
Yes, you may.
Sure, thank you. My impression of reading this bill the first time is that it says there are other ways to calculate what the total appropriate judgment ought to be. If an organization, for example, has business records that indicate how many people were injured or a variety of other things, are you suggesting that that's not a fair way to determine or an appropriate way to determine what the total class of risk is by using other methods?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, that's not my contention. Courts are very, very attentive and protective to the rights of absent class members, and they are attentive and protective of those rights by ensuring that the notice that they get of a class action complies with due process. And one of the protections that's in the federal rule but is not in House Bill 2700 is that class members in a damages class action must receive the best notice practicable. And often that's direct notice through the mail or a very vigorous indirect notice program. So, I endorse every conceivable effort to make sure that absent class members do receive notice of a possible claim and then are allowed their due process rights to make a decision, am I going to make the claim or not?
I guess the answer was yes then to my question.
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Okay. You?
No.
Okay. Ms. Earls, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries and also today appearing before you on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition in opposition to House Bill 2700. I believe I handed out testimony to you a little bit ago. It should have come to you electronically. And with that testimony also came the written statement of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition, which includes a list of organizations that are opposed to House Bill 2700 in its current form. Before I get started, let me just be clear that nothing about my testimony is intended to imply any lack of support for legal aid or the importance of that organization and funding for it in the state of Oregon.
I'm only speaking to one particular part of the bill, and I just want to be clear that I'm not particularly taking a position on legal aid here. AOI represents roughly 1,500 businesses in this state, and those businesses provide almost 200,000 jobs to workers across the state. All of those companies need a stable, dependable legal environment in order to run their businesses and continue to provide jobs. Oregon may never be the cheapest place to do business, but it could be the most stable place to do business. And the business community values stability very, very highly. A stable business climate allows companies to plan effectively at all levels, from how many people they can hire, to the type and amount of raw material they purchase, to when they ship and deliver their product. A stable business climate, of course, also promotes a strong economy, which is something I think we're all in search of at this point. Unfortunately, our position is that House Bill 2700, as written, would seriously erode the stability of Oregon's legal system because it disposes of the well-established rules by which damages and class actions are currently determined and applies new rules to cases that have already been tried and verdict rendered. This committee is probably aware, in fact, I think you've already talked about it today, that there are some pending class actions in Oregon right now, one of which will soon be subject to significant judgment. And it's really tempting to make this bill apply to those cases in order to capture funds for Oregon legal aid. But in reality, legal aid's unlikely to realize revenue from that case this biennium, maybe not next biennium, and possibly not ever. Imposing such procedural changes midstream is fundamentally unfair to all parties, plaintiffs and defendants alike, and it's also highly unusual for the legislature to apply new rules to cases that are in process somewhere all the way up the appeals chain. And that's what we see basically in Section 5 of this bill. And it's not only a prospective change in the way damages are awarded, because defendants have made settlement decisions, determined strategy, and won lost motions based on the rules as they were in place when those lawsuits were filed and argued. Class members, which are basically those people who have actually suffered damages, have already been notified of their rights under the rules that are currently in place, and they've made decisions based on those rules. Changing rules in the middle of the game creates uncertainty, seriously destabilizes Oregon's legal system, and sends a terrible message to businesses that are looking for a good place to do business. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes. Hi, thank you for being here today. I have just a factual question, and that is the BP matter, was that settled or was that a jury verdict matter?
Chair Barker, Representative Lindegar, it was a jury verdict.
Okay, thanks.
And I have a question. So the final judgment has not been made on that case yet, is that correct? Their final judgment has not.
Chair Barker, that's correct. No judgment has been entered.
And so then if that case was settled today, this wouldn't affect it. But if it's settled after we pass, after this bill, if the legislature passes it and it goes into effect, then if the judgment comes later, they would be liable there. Is that my, I don't know if I said that clearly.
You're thinking of the point in time.
The point in time is
yeah, that we were describing.
So Chair Barker, just to be clear, in the BP matter currently in Portland, we have completed the claims process. That process successfully reached over 80% of the potential class members. Judgment has not been entered in that case, but is expected to soon.
Okay, follow up. Okay, I just want to clarify, though, what the chair was just trying to ask there. If this goes into law as it's written right now, are they going to be, will it be subject to that?
Chair Barker, Representative Olson, that's correct. The way that I read the retroactivity provision in this legislation, it applies to all cases, even cases that have been adjudicated through judgment and are on appeal.
But Mr. Daniels, you're saying that that action has not yet happened, right? Judgment has not yet been entered. That is a prospective thing that will be happening in this case.
Chair Barker, Representative Williamson, that's correct in the BP case.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Representative. Just one more question. Your statement about BP is that 80% of the people who have been injured have been identified. Under this bill, the resources that would go to legal aid would represent the other 20%?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I'm not sure, because of the way this bill is written, how that would impact the pending BP matter, BP West Coast Products matter, primarily because the claims process has been completed. And what this bill does in Section O is allow the court to dispense with the claims process if it's not practicable to do so. So I just don't have an answer to how this legislation would operate.
Yes, Representative Post.
I'm not even sure who to direct this question to. I might be about five testifiers behind. So, but it just, you have to help me here. I'm trying to understand. Maybe Representative Williamson would be best. I'm sorry if I'm directing to you now. I'm trying to work my way through this and understand this. Because it was brought up, I think, by the Attorney General, tobacco settlement, let's say, or pollutants into the ground, that sort of thing. Okay, so we have a settlement for that. 80% of the people are reached, 20% aren't, so there's this leftover money in this settlement. This is a dumb question, but it's what I have to ask. What does that have to do with legal aid? Not that I have anything wrong with legal aid.
Right.
What I'm saying is why not give it specifically to each class action suit what matches that class action suit? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes, you
so
can.
if you're talking about that 100%, 80% gets paid out to people. So they've identified that you, in fact, were injured, you're a smoker, whatever, but you are a member of the class. They found you. You filled out your note card and sent it back saying, yes, I am a member of the class, and you got your money. And 80% of the identified class did that. That 20% left over currently in Oregon law stays with the defendant.
Right.
The Supreme Court has said, and courts have ruled on, saying that that 20% can go to the next best thing. That's the CyPRE doctrine, that it can go to a class that is like the injured class or to a service like legal aid that impacts access to the courts. So the courts have ruled on what that 20% can be used for if they can't find you. So that's unclaimed. I think what Mr. Daniels was talking about earlier about checks that aren't cash, that's lost property. That's a different thing than unclaimed damages. But what we're talking about is that 20% of the people we can't find, but the court has still awarded those damages. So the court or the jury has still said, here's how much you owe because of the damages you did. If they can't find those people, it's that 20% that's left over that what we're talking about. So in this bill, 50% would be directed to legal aid because we know the courts have ruled on that, saying that legal aid is an appropriate place for those dollars. And the court can either give 100% of the unclaimed damages to legal aid because we know that's a safe place from a legal perspective to send them, or they can say this nonprofit or this charitable organization also addresses the kinds of injury that the plaintiffs have suffered, and we can help the people that we don't know who they are, but we know they had this kind of issue, and so maybe it's smoking cessation or whatever, but it can be it's closer to the injury, even if we can't find that 20% of those individuals. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. And now we'll try to get Mr. Basner on the phone. Okay. Hello, Mr. Beisner?
Yes, it is.
Okay, this is Representative Jeff Barker in the House Judiciary Committee in Oregon, and we're looking for your testimony on House Bill 2700. If you could identify yourself for the record and who you are and who you represent.
Yes,
and then just go ahead and give us your testimony, and then I'll allow questions when you're through, if you're ready, if you'd like to take them.
Absolutely. Well, I'm John Beisner. I'm a partner with the Stanton Arts Law Firm in Washington, D.C., and I'm speaking here today on behalf of the Institute for Legal Reform. My apologies to all of you for not being able to be there in person, but due to a court appearance I had today here in Anchorage, Alaska, I'm not able to be there in person, but I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the committee on this bill. I've been watching the hearing on the internet and noted that most of the discussion so far has concerned the aspect of the bill that would direct Cypre proceeds to the Oregon State Bar Group. And I wanted to address the other 50% aspect of the bill that would authorize Oregon courts to send half of the Cypre amounts to charities. I guess I would start by saying that there's been a lot of discussion about the Cypre being broadly accepted, and in some respects that's true. But this notion of courts taking Cypre proceeds and making decisions about sending them actually extremely controversial, and I think the committee needs to be aware of that fact in considering this bill. Indeed, toward the end of 2013, the United States Supreme Court was asked to do an examination of whether Cypre should be permitted in such circumstances or the circumstances under which it should be permitted in the Supreme and the federal court system. The Supreme Court decided not to accept the particular case that was presented for procedural reasons, but the Chief Justice took the unusual step of issuing a statement in that case that basically invites practitioners to look for a case to bring before the U.S. Supreme Court to consider a series of questions. And I'm looking now at his statement, but he's talking about the court looking for an opportunity to address fundamental concerns surrounding the use of such remedies in class action, including when, if ever, such relief should be considered, how to assess its fairness as a general matter, whether new entities may be established, that is, new charities may be established as part of such relief. If not, how should existing entities, that is, charities, be selected, what the respective roles of the judge and parties are in shaping a Cypre remedy, and how closely the goals of any enlisted organization must correspond to the interests of the class, and so on. And so it's entirely possible that the U.S. Supreme Court, in the not-too-distant future, if they can find the case to look at, will be addressing and perhaps expressing disagreement with this provision. Why is this provision controversial? And I think it boils down to the following, and that is the risk of conflicts of interest. The federal court system has been seeing a number of these cases in which conflicts of interest have been exposed in terms of deciding what charities should receive these awards. For example, in the Fairchild versus America Online case, this was a case in the Central District of California, one of the named plaintiffs in the lawsuit, it turned out later, was employed by one of the charities that was selected to get the Cypre money, raising conflicts of interest question there. There's also been concerns expressed about conflicts of interest between the class council and the charities that are selected. There was a lot of publicity a couple of years ago, especially an article in the National Law Journal about a settlement in an antitrust case in which there was a fairly large unclaimed amount, and it was decided that money should go to establish a center for competition law at a law school. And as it turned out, the lead counsel in the lawsuit was an alumnus of that law school and took a lot of credit for setting that up. and raise questions about a conflict of interest. The other problem is the potential of courts having a conflict of interest in these issues. There have been some cases where it turned out upon inspection that the courts were being asked to send money to charities in which they or family members had some interest. And there was a New York Times article not long ago. The article was entitled "Doling Out Other People's Money," that emphasized the growing problem of charities actually going to judges and making solicitation for residual settlement money. And this has caused a number of scholars and judges, I think, to raise concerns about the wisdom of that, as were quoted in that New York Times article. I'd note, for example, that former federal judge David Levy, who sat on the bench in the Eastern District of California and is now the dean at the Duke Law School, said, quote, "Allowing judges to choose how to spend other people's money is not a true judicial function and can lead to abuses." And I would also note a decision by a federal court in the District of Maine several years ago that was asked to consider a Cypre award, and that judge wrote, quote, "Judges are not generally equipped to be charitable foundations. We are not accountable to boards or members for funding decisions we make. We are not accustomed to deciding whether certain nonprofit entities are more deserving of limited funds than others, and we do not have the institutional resources and competencies to monitor that grantees abide by the conditions we or the settlement agreement set." So the issue that I wanted to raise with the committee is the fact that second 50% provision is in fact very controversial, and it's something that the federal courts in particular have been wrestling with and addressing those conflict issues. But again, it's something that the Supreme Court may weigh in upon because it is becoming an increasing source of concern. One last comment that I wanted to raise as well is with respect to the predicate for this section, and that is the provision that says that the Cypre awards may be permitted, quote, "if the court finds that payment of all or part of the damages to class members is not practicable." And I wanted to focus on the not practicable aspects of that. I think that as a policy matter, I would have some concerns about that not practical provision not being resolved. I thought the Attorney General did an excellent job earlier of noting that in most class settlements, distributing the money isn't easy. Finding the members of the class is not easy, and sometimes it costs more to distribute the money than the actual amount that you get distributed. It's been my experience in working with class actions. But that money that you are distributing belongs to the class. It doesn't belong to the state, it doesn't belong to the charity, it doesn't belong to anybody else. And you shouldn't be taking that away from the class unless it is in fact impossible to distribute the money in any way. And I just wanted to voice a concern about that not practicable provision perhaps being interpreted too broadly, such that courts would say, oh, this, it's just too hard to get the money back to the class members, this is going to cost too much, so we'll just take all this money that it should be going to injured parties and move it off to charities, particularly if you have these conflicts of interest that are at play, none of which are addressed in the legislation. And I appreciate the opportunity to address those issues.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Mr. Beissner, this is Jennifer Williamson. I'm a state representative from downtown Portland. When you talk about practicability, you know what I'm saying, the court is still bound by due process. The judge can't just decide it's too hard not to look for those plaintiffs, right?
Well, this provision, it says not practicable, and I could see it's not defined here. It doesn't say it must be consistent with due process. And the provision could easily, well, if it's going to cost more to distribute the money than the money we're likely to distribute, that's not practicable. Some people would say that's the conclusion. But that's true in most class settlements, that you end up often paying more. I shouldn't say it's in most class settlements, but in many class settlements, by the time you get finished with advertising and all of that, you're not spending as much to let the class members know that the money is available than the amount that you actually distribute.
This is Jennifer Williamson again. I just want to make sure that I'm hearing you correctly, because just because we don't put that the court is bound by due process in the language of the bill does not mean that the court is not bound by due process in making that decision.
It seems to me, I mean, that was the issue that was before the Supreme Court in the Marsh versus Wayne case. In that settlement, the court said, gee, it's too hard to distribute this money, and so as a matter of due process, we're going to give it all to the charity right up front. And those are the parameters. You know, the court said it's not practicable. And this was the issue that the Supreme Court is asking to take up, or the parameters. And what I'm saying is I'm not sure, you know, not practicable, would necessarily communicate to the courts what the parameters of the use of Cypre should be.
Anything else? Okay. So I'd like to just ask, and I'm the non-lawyer. So the proponents of this bill, a couple of years ago or a couple of sessions ago when they first started this, the money was destined for something else, and I don't remember what it was. And even some of the opponents said, well, if it was going to legal aid, that would be different. And so now that it's been changed to go to legal aid. But the kind of the basic question is, if a judgment, and we just use the number $100 million, I don't care, you could say $100, and they only can find 80% of that to give out, why should the person who has done the wrong thing, who has been found essentially guilty in the civil matter, pay that? Why should they be able to keep that 20%?
Yeah, what I'm talking about here is when, how far you go in terms of figuring out that you can't find them. I mean, if, as one of the witnesses talked about earlier, you sent them checks, they haven't cashed them, and apparently you don't intend to cash them, you're going to have money there, and you have to decide what to do with that, and that probably is an appropriate use of the Cypre doctrine. The risk that I'm talking about is, as has been happening in some cases in the federal courts, and that's what the Supreme Court wants to take a look at, they draw that practicability line at a lot different place and are saying, gee, this is just going to be too hard. We're only giving out $20, and we're not sure how to find these people, so let's just give it all to charity to start with. And so that's really the concern, is at what point do you give up on trying to get the money to the class? That the class council, bear in mind, are probably don't have a lot of incentive to get that money to the class members, because it doesn't make that much difference to them. And so it's got to be the court that is pressing very hard to make sure that the injured party, the people who have actually won the award, get the money. I'm not talking about whether or not it goes back to the wrongdoer in the case of the defendant. I'm talking about, is the maximum effort being made to actually get it in the hands of the people who allegedly were injured?
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? I want to thank you very much for taking the time, and I know we understand how attorneys get busy and get tied up, but we appreciate you taking the time to have this phone call from Alaska and to testify before the committee. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Good night.
So I guess just I would really appreciate it tomorrow. We're going to move forward with this, if Tim could come back then and share his view on dash ones.
You'll have a chance to look at the dash ones in the meantime.
Sure.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2700, and we will reopen that tomorrow with possible work session. So we do this every 15 minutes. Just a public hearing. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2340.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 2340 comes to you from the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm going to move my microphone a little closer. It seeks to protect personal information by restricting identifying information in certain documents. It would restrict Social Security numbers, taxpayer identification numbers, driver's license numbers, and would require only the last four on certain publicly available documents. We understand that there is an amendment in the works on this bill, so it is not ready to move today.
Okay, thank you. Joshua and Johanna again, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Josh Nasby. I'm with the Office of the State Court Administrator in the Oregon Judicial Department. Appreciate you hearing House Bill 2340 today. As committee counsel just mentioned, we've got a little bit of work to do, so I'll look forward to working with each of you in the future to sort of fine-tune the bill. But I'm here today to talk about what the bill does and what we're trying to do. And I will be mindful of your time and give you the quick version. So House Bill 2340 is an e-court bill that's intended to protect the personal information of court users in an electronic court world. As many of you may know, we're in the middle of a multi-year transitional phase from a paper-based court system using our legacy case management tool, which is known as OGIN, to a more modern e-court environment. And as we're looking down the road at this process, one of the next steps is to provide general access to the public, much like the federal courts do today. And one of the tasks we're engaged in at this point is we're looking at those documents that can and cannot be publicly disclosed. And as we look at those documents that can be disclosed, we're vetting those to ensure that we're minimizing risks associated with court documents that contain personal information. And so for that reason, the bill identifies a number of statutory requirements where personal information is required to be included. And the goal here is for us to produce what I'll call clean documents so that we can leverage efficiencies in e-courts and post those online without having to redact them by hand. And just to be clear, when I say online, I don't mean via a Google search. I mean via a registration process with the court. And so the bill does three things. The first involves taxpayer identification numbers. These are effectively a business's Social Security number, and right now the law requires that the full taxpayer identification number be included in civil judgments and a corresponding document called a lien record abstract. Based on a recommendation from tax court practitioners who cite federal bankruptcy court as a model, sections 1 and 3 of the bill truncate taxpayer identification numbers to protect businesses in the same way that we protect the Social Security numbers of individuals. The second change proposed by House Bill 2340 involves Social Security numbers and driver's license numbers in paternity proceedings. The statutes on the books right now require that these numbers be included in full in the judgment. However, the Legislative Assembly has provided the Chief Justice with rulemaking authority, and he's exercised that authority, and so those numbers are truncated as a practical matter or not included in the judgment at all. But Sections 4 and the 5 of the bill make clear that we're not going to include full Social Security numbers and driver's license in paternity judgments. The third change proposed by House Bill 2340 is intended to prohibit the inclusion of the victim's name and address in a criminal judgment in which the defendant's ordered to pay restitution. And the thinking here is that criminal judgments are a class of documents that the public's very interested in, and we'd like to be able to make them available electronically without exposing the victim to the possibility of additional victimization. So we think this is a good bill, should pass, but not today. We've got more work to do on this third change involving criminal judgments. And the short version is we've got technological challenges in our legacy courts that still use OGIN. So we'd like to work through those in conjunction with you and our partners in the public safety system, come back in a short period of time with an amendment and go from there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, thanks for having me here again this afternoon. I'll also give you the brief version of my position, the position of the Oregon District Attorneys Association as well, regarding House Bill 2340. In short, one of the primary concerns that crime victims come into the criminal justice system is having concerns regarding safety. And this bill, in many ways, is looking to create extra layers of safety for crime victims. Specifically in Section 7, it mentions that a judgment should not have the name or the address of a victim. And I think that the bill was and is written in context primarily with regard to financial aspects of a judgment, which is important. In many cases, crime victims are ordered restitution for their financial loss as a direct result of a crime, and so restitution is ordered to crime victims, and it makes sense that perhaps their physical address should not be in a judgment that is accessible to the public. However, there are some concerns with regard to the way that the bill is currently written. And interestingly, they work in opposition to victim safety. The reason that many judgments have crime victims' names is to institute no contact orders. And so a judgment may say the defendant may not have any direct or indirect contact with victim Mary Smith. If we are not able to put the victim's name in that judgment, enforceability becomes a problem. If a law enforcement officer is out on a scene of an incident, they've been called to respond, how are they to know that this offender may not have contact with Mary Smith if it is not in a judgment? Oftentimes law enforcement will go on scene, they'll call in their administrative person will look up LEDS information and find out that Mary Smith is not to be contacted by this offender. Without this information, how does law enforcement know to make an arrest based upon a probation violation? Number two, probation officers won't have that information. So again, if a probation officer is seeking to enforce a no contact order, basically the on the ground work providing safety to crime victims, if they don't know who the defendant is not to have contact with, it's very hard to enforce that. And finally, there are several crimes in the ORS that have enhanced sanction and consequence for defendants who victimize the same victim the second time around. So, for example, if a domestic violence abuser were to assault his partner, we'll use Mary Smith again, that's generally charged as an assault for misdemeanor. If he assaults her again, the same victim again, that's an assault for felony. If that name is not in the judgment, it is very challenging to charge that enhanced second time around case. So I fully support the protections for crime victims, but we have to make sure that logistically this is playing out as it should. It is very challenging, particularly we know abusers move geographically and isolate their victims geographically, and so it's very hard moving from county to county for Washington County to know what defendant, what victim a defendant perpetrated a crime against in Lane County without that name on the judgment. So we'd have to do some workarounds with that, and I think it can be done, but in the current language, it actually ends up putting crime victims potentially in a less safe position. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any further? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2340. Any further business to come before the committee? Thank you for attending. We're adjourned.